I'm Canadian. And he would, on Tuesday morning, this is Thursday, on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, we would go into a room, and of course back then all this fanciness was not there, and he would take this plastic sheet and he would put it on this overhead projector. And he had a pair of calipers that were about this large, they were made of wood, and he would walk around and he would hand you the caliper, which meant that you were now officially dead, because you had to take this thing and you had to go up there and you had to actually measure the intervals and talk about P waves and little minutiae. And then he would sit back and he would ask questions and you would bury yourself deeper and deeper. And so we used to call it Tuesday morning flip and fry rounds. From that, the reason for the story and from that I learned is that even though he gave me an appreciation for electrocardiography, he didn't make it fun to learn it. This is the most boring subject in your entire repertoire of things. This is not how to put in a central line, or this isn't any of that kind of stuff, right? But this is the stuff that will kill people when you as a doctor don't recognize what it is. Electrocardiography used to involve a very central place in medical care. And if you guys go back 30 years in history or 40 years in history, it was taught like that. So I just want to make sure you get a little philosophy so you understand why you should treat it the way you should. Electrocardiography has been relegated to a specialty or a business that you learn once in a while here and there. There's no organized way to teach it. There are books, but no one reads them. And the emphasis on the EKG when it arrives at the patient's bedside is very minimal compared to what it used to be. The reason is that we learned to do so much with it. So many interventions, so many therapies, dangerous drugs, this and that and the other. Everybody knows that if it looks bad, refer it. And that's the reason why a lot of guys do is learn that this is bad. And that's so today, even a cardiologist looking at a complex EKG consults it away. So it's a philosophy by which you guys can understand this very basic art has been relegated to this. But if you learn some basic things, you can use it to save yourselves in your careers and your patients. So this is an EKG. Everybody knows it has 12 leads. How many people here are perfectly comfortable with reading an EKG? All right, well, that makes it easy. How many people know, is there anybody in this room who doesn't understand that the heart's an electrical organ, that it is a sinus node, an AV node? Nobody here has any problem with the fact that the AV node produces a bundle of His, which produces a series of bundle branches and His-Purkinje tissue. Everybody's happy with that basic stuff. And remember, there's no jeopardy in this session. The more stupid mistakes you make, the better you will look to me, okay? That's right. That's how you learn. So can anybody here just quickly tell me where the sinus node is? Where is it? What is this thing called the sinus node, sinoatrial node? Where is it? Somewhere in the heart's a good... That's the, all right. Well, the sinoatrial node is an atrial structure. Anybody have a problem with that? Okay. Well, let's put it someplace, because we can use that someplace for thinking. We're going to put it high and on the back wall of the right atrium. It's called the crista terminalis. It's an ellipsoid group of cells on the posterolateral aspect of the right atrium. And this puppy has these cells that do this. And if you remember back to Arthur C. Guyton and physiology, remember those action potentials you dearly wished you'd never had to learn? Well, there were two kinds of them. There were those guys that went up and did this, and you all remember that. And then there was these weird-looking things that they would draw once in a while. Would go up kind of slow and do this. Those things were from the automatic cells. And what happens is that they, when they go back to baseline, they keep eroding and then they fire. So that's what the sinoatrial node is. The group of cells with the most rapid firing, so it happens to control the rest of the business. But that's the first point. The second point to remember, electrocardiography is like using photography. Everything you own on here, on the leads that you look at, is a camera. It's a photograph of an event. And if you remember back now, of course, they don't give us those cheap freebies from the drug companies. But remember those wheels you could get or the things you could get to calculate axis or which lead was where? If you can find one in ancient history, put it away in your... It's worth having until you memorize it. That is unfortunately the only memorization you'll have to do, is have some idea of what lead goes where, because every lead is a camera that looks at the heart from only one place. So remember, one of the drawings on those wheels used to be that lead one is 0 degrees, lead AVL is minus 30 degrees, lead two is 60 degrees, AVF is 90, lead three is 120. You guys familiar with what I'm saying? I mean, this isn't... And when you look at that, you look at it with a sense of bewilderment, like, I don't know what the hell that means. Okay, so what does that mean? And that's how I felt when I was a resident. So listen, that's normal. But this is a concept you won't find in a book, but it works. Treat it like it is a camera that looks at the heart from there. 0 degrees. So going back to the sinus node, which is here, high in the posterolateral right atrium, if it produces electrical current and your camera looks at the heart from 0 degrees, it sees the electricity coming towards it, right? Because it's coming from the right to the left. By convention and the way all EKGs are organized, every time something comes at you, it produces a positive deflection. If it goes away from you, it produces a negative deflection. Got to memorize that. That's a fact you have to remember, all right? So look at what happens now. This starts to make sense, because if the camera is looking at it from here and the sinus node produces a P wave that goes this way, what will the P wave look like? Will it be positive or negative? Okay, so if the sinus node comes from here and the lead two is at 60 degrees looking at it from here, will it be positive or negative? And lead three, which is at 120 degrees from here, will that be positive or negative? It'll be positive. Now, if you go back, somewhere in the didactic teaching that you've had, it said for it to be called sinus rhythm, there have to be positive P waves. You remember this, any of you? Do you remember this? This is a fact that's in the book. For something to be called sinus rhythm, it does not mean that you have to have a P before every QRS. It means that the P in lead 1, 2, and 3 have to be positive. Does everybody get it? So if you ever call me for a consult and you say this is sinus rhythm, you will have looked at the P waves of 1, 2, and 3. Anybody in this room have a problem with what I just said? Does it make sense? Is there a question? Ask it. The more stupid you look, the better you look. This is the only way you will get this boring stuff. So that's sinus rhythm. Very easy. PR intervals reflect what? The calcium-gated dependent tissue in the AV node that produces a delay before it conducts. And then you have a QRS, and we'll talk about this. So this is normal sinus rhythm. And I'm just going to put up EKGs and talk about them today and kind of give you guys flavors for how you want to approach things. Attending gives you an EKG. You get it in your hand. And before you crap your drawers, put yourself in a state of mind that says, not Zen, says, I got to start with a P wave. Always, always, always. It doesn't matter whether a glaring infarction is showing up here somewhere. Start with a P wave. And is the P wave sinus? And that's always 1, 2, and 3. Always do that. Every time, you won't ever get it wrong. Is the rhythm sinus? Even if it's not connected to the QRS, is the rhythm sinus? Complete heart block still has sinus rhythm. But it's just that it's not connected. All right. So then you look at you look at the PR interval. So the PR interval here is normal or not? Kind of borderline. 200 milliseconds, one big square is first degree AV block after. That's this borderline. QRS complex width from here is 82 milliseconds. That's normal. So this is just normal sinus rhythm. I just put it up here to talk a little bit about this. EKGs, all of them. So let's do the same thing. Anybody want to volunteer the issue of whether or not they think this is sinus rhythm? Remember, the attending just gave you this, and you're standing there, and he's asking you to read it. What do you see? You're welcome to come up here and look at it if you're not sure. What do you call this? Is this sinus rhythm? Yes, and it could be bradycardia if it's less than 60. Someone said that. That's a good point. Is it sinus? How do you get around this question? I just got finished telling you that you got to go from the right to the left, from there to there. So let's start, do that. Does that look like it goes from the right to the left, gives you a positive P wave? Well, it might, but it's all kind of fishy looking. And then here, some of it goes down. That looks okay, doesn't it? That one looks okay. So are you going to call this sinus rhythm? And you have a problem then, don't you, if you've begun to understand what I just talked about. So how do you answer the attending? Well, what rhythm is it? Well, it's sinus rhythm. If your attending is like everybody else, he'll just let it slide because he doesn't know this either. All right? You're going to say this is possibly sinus rhythm. It's an atrial rhythm that does not meet all the criteria of sinus rhythm. Its rate, regular automaticity at a sinus-like rate, suggests sinus rhythm. Now, this could be a post-open heart patient who's had a variety of rotations. Funny enough, that's one of those facts you don't see in a book, but I see because I do enough of this. You know, you irritate a heart, pericarditis, myocarditis, you do anything to it. Even if it's in sinus rhythm, a lot of the time the P wave gets funny. It's a fact that I've seen again and again and again. And that's why if you read in the obscure textbooks, one of the findings of pericarditis involves things like PR, depression, because there's some really peculiar things that happen. So this is possibly sinus rhythm. Is the AV node conduction time normal? Not, right? So you can read it off of here. You don't have to, you know, it says 270 milliseconds. So what's that called? So if you had first-degree AV block, it means that there's a QRS that follows every P wave, but follows it after 200 milliseconds. So if there was a QRS that followed every P wave and it followed it after 400 milliseconds, would that be first-degree AV block? Would still be first-degree AV block. So let's have some fun with this, because this is a concept you can get. If I took a normal heart, you guys don't have a normal heart, you doctors, but if I took a normal person off the street and I stuck a catheter in their atrium and I dialed in a pacing rate from a catheter in the right atrium and I started pacing them and they're going at 100 now, PQRS, and then I dialed in 150. Remember, that's a normal heart. And I started pushing that heart. What would happen is the distance between the P wave and the QRS is going to start to increase. I can make your heart develop first-degree AV block if I pushed it hard enough. And then here's the fun part of that. Remember, you have a normal PR interval right now. But if I stuck a catheter in there and I dialed in a high rate, I would make you develop first-degree AV block. Does anybody want to care to guess what's going to happen if I dialed in even a faster rate? As I started to get longer and longer and longer, I'm going to do what? I'm going to drop a QRS. What do you call that, where once in a while you prolong the PR interval and then you drop a QRS? What do you call that? You call it second degree, something called Wenke back, or don't ever use the word Mobitz in this classroom. It's very dangerous to do that. A guy should be shot, but that's another lecture. Anyway, look, so it becomes second degree type 1 AV block. How interesting is that? Because now, if I take an older guy with coronary disease and I make his AV node sick, rather than going at 150, he's going 60, and now he's got this, long first degree, and if I stuck a catheter in his heart, and I started accelerating the atrium, he would drop his QRS a little faster, wouldn't he? About 90 or 100 beats a minute, he would show Wenke back. Now, if you take a guy who's sicker yet, when the sinus node is going at 60, he drops them, you call him second degree type 1 AV block. So what did you learn from this? From sinus rhythm to Wenke back is just a continuum of disease. You give it different names, but it is a continuum of the same process. The sicker the AV node gets, the easier it drops its impulses. And you see that. You get it? So never in your mind from now till you die should you ever connect second degree type 1 AV block with type 2 AV block. They have nothing whatsoever to do with each other. Don't think of it as a Mobitz classification that tends to make it the same thing in your mind. It's not. The disease is different. The prognosis is different. The treatment is different. Everything is different. Don't treat type 1 and type 2 as being the same thing. They are radically different phenomena. So remember, from sinus rhythm to first degree AV block to Wenke back is a continuum of the same process. It's the sicker you get, the more you demonstrate it with slower rates. That's all. So we have sinus rhythm. We have first degree AV block. Anybody else want to call anything else here? The QRS is 138. Who said left anterior hemi block? Shit, you know too much. Jesus, did you hear that? Before we get to the PhD of this, is there anything else wrong with this thing? That's, you're correct, absolutely correct. What other kind of block is there here? Is there any other kind of block? Where the terminal vector forces in this EKG all go to the right, for example. If I look at the heart from V5 and V6, everything at the end of it looks to the right. It goes away from V5 and V6. If I look at AVR, everything at the end goes towards AVR. So all the terminal depolarizations occurring in this EKG are headed to the right because something on the right is not conducting it to start with, called right bundle branch block. Funny enough, the point I want to make here is you guys will memorize the idea that if you see rabbit ears in V1, it's right bundle branch block. That's a good idea. You can memorize that. Anybody here memorize that fact already? You kind of look at that and say, V1, rabbit ears, right bundle. I know I can say that. The attendee's going to shoot me. You guys are there with that, right? You've heard this. But here's a little trick for you to remember. Not, yes. Not everything, sure. Not everything that is rabbit ears is right bundle. And it's a one-hour lecture about bundle branch blocks. And, you know, I've decided against doing those things. You guys don't remember all those fancy rules I produced. But look, the rabbit ears are caused by something simple. The first issue is, the first R is, if your intraventricular septum is there, and I'm the dummy, and this is the right, and this is the left, and this is the septum. This is the right bundle, and that's the left bundle. If I lose my right bundle, I'm going to go down the left bundle, and I'm going to depolarize my septum from the left to the right. Everybody understand that? So if I begin, and I put a lead on the right side, it's going to show me what? A positive deflection, because I'm going from the left of the septum to the right. Everybody get this idea? No problem? So lead V1, which is on the right side, shows this little R wave. That's caused by the fact that the septum goes across there. And then the left bundle takes everything down here and depolarizes this with his Perkin G transmission at 5 meters a minute or whatever the hell that is, a second. Now, after that, the right bundle is not there. And you use what's called intercalated disc transfer. You don't have his Perkin G fibers because you've lost the bundle, so you've got to transfer the current all the way to the right side. It takes time. So everything that takes time is represented by the temporal sequence of an EKG. Everything at the end of a QRS is the last thing that happened. And the last thing that happens is always on the right. So the rule is, if you have a bundle branch block on that side, everything has to depolarize at the end. And so all the vector forces at the end of a QRS have to go right, because this is the part that the right bundle never depolarized, which is why when you're not sure, the RSR pattern doesn't look right, you're worried about it, look at where the QRS is going. And look at that. All the terminal forces go right. All right? V5 and V6 produce negative S waves. Lead V1, lead AVR produces a terminal R wave. And that's why you get a big terminal R pattern in V1. Everybody get that? Sinus rhythm, first degree AV block. Well, now that he's raised the issue, maybe we should trap him into thinking about what a hemi block really is. First of all, how many people in this room have never heard the word left anterior hemi block? Anybody like that? And he can't answer, but is there anyone else in this room who wants to try to explain what they think hemi block is? You're not going to look bad in front of your friends, and I don't care if you don't know. I'm just wondering if you have a concept. Try it. Okay, perfectly correct. And in electrocardiographic terms, that has representation. And that representation, I have read many versions of it. It's never taught well. Anybody here ever read something about hemiblock? You guys have read something about it at some point? And I'm willing to bet if you were like I was, you can't understand that. It doesn't make sense. You look at it and say, okay, but I, how am I supposed to use that information? What does it mean? Let me just clarify this so you can put it away as one fact you learned today. Mayo Clinic, 7-county study. This is when you guys weren't born, some of you. And what they did is they looked at people with EKGs that showed left anterior hemi block. And left anterior hemi block was associated with mortality. The isolated presence of this one finding reduces your expectation of life. So it became something to know, because then you want to see why it's there and so on. All right. So what he said is something about a fascicle. Anybody here who doesn't know what a fascicle is? Because if you don't, I'll tell you. Don't be afraid. You understand what the word fascicle means? It just means the pieces that make up the complete left bundle. They're pieces. There's a bundle of His. Remember that drawing? You have the little knobby thing that looks, that dip draws the AV node, and then it comes down, there's a wire, and then there's the two right and left bundle branches, and then they draw these little things. Well, in electrocardiographic terms, think of the left bundle as dividing into two main pieces. Right? One goes this way, one goes this way. And if you ruin one of these two, it produces this EKG. Let's try it, all right? Let's try and see if you get this. Tell me if you don't. I need to know that. So the two fascicles, one goes anteriorly into the left. I'm the dummy. So one goes anteriorly into the left, and the other goes posteriorly into the right. On the left side of the interventricular septum, where the left bundle is, you're going to drive one set of wires anteriorly into the left, and the other you're going to drive posteriorly into the right. So let's block off the anterior and to the left fascicle. I'm going to cut it. Take a pair of scissors. Cut it. Now, when you produced sinus rhythm and the current went down into the left bundle, this is gone, right? It's not there. So if there's any lead that looks at the heart from here, that would be what? Lead one. We talked about one. And what's the lead that looks at the heart from minus 30 degrees? Anybody know? AVL. So one in AVL normally expect to see some current coming at them because the left anterior fascicle goes that way. But what do? We just cut it. We wrecked it. So one in AVL don't see the current they're supposed to see. So if the current goes away from one in AVL, what's going to happen to the initial deflection in one in AVL? You'll get a what? You'll get a Q wave. Nobody have a problem with that? Everybody get it? Little Q wave and one in AVL? Just remember that fact. I'm going to come back to it, and you're going to forever make a very interesting distinction in your head. So the Q wave formed in one in AVL because you lost the anterior hemifascicle. Now, let's keep going. What did we say before when we talked about the right bundle? If you lose His Purkinje tissue, it takes a lot longer to depolarize that tissue because you don't have rapid current transfer. And if it takes a lot longer to depolarize that tissue, the vectors that go there become the terminus of the QRS and force the axis to go that way. So in this EKG, The axis, we'll go back to the word axis in a minute. In this EKG, the axis is leftward. So, and let's use the machine. It says minus 58 milliseconds. The axis is leftward in this EKG. And so what you're going to say is left anterior hemi block, because there's a Q wave and one in AVL and the axis. So let me ask a question. What's the difference between left axis deviation and left anterior hemi block? Anybody want to try that? If you had to think about it from what you just heard me say, can you come up with a way of saying, well, this is left axis deviation and this is left anterior hemi block. Is there some factor that you would point at? Yeah. They're all, the axis is not going to affect, it could affect the width of the QRS. That's a good try, but it's not going to be a differentiator. You could have a wider QRS. I completely agree with that point. But it's not an absolute differentiator. You're correct. You're not incorrect. But it doesn't help you to always say. So if you have someone with left axis deviation, is their hemifascicle intact? Let's make it intact for your head. Their left anterior hemifascicle is intact, and they have left axis deviation. So when the QRS begins in a person with left axis deviation where the fascicle is not broken, are you going to get the Q waves? No. And if in left anterior hemi block it is broken, are you going to get the Q waves? Yes. So the difference between left axis deviation and left anterior hemi block is the presence of Q waves. You won't find this written very easily in a book, but this is the way to remember it. Well, it's got left axis deviation. And then you wonder about why that's important. And then someone says, well, isn't it hemi block? And now you're totally confused. Please don't be. This is really, really easy. If you got Q waves here, call it hemi block. If you don't call it. You'll never be wrong. So for fun, grins and giggles, if I lost the thing that goes down and to the right, so the only vectors that occur are the ones that go anteriorly and laterally. What will happen to the initial deflection in one in AVL? If I lost the posterior hemifascicle and now I was going this way, this was the way I was going to go, what was going to happen to lead one in AVL? Are they going to produce, what kind of an initial deflection will they produce? They'll produce an R wave. All right? Now, if I lost the thing that's going to the right, what do you think will happen to the axis of the QRS? It'll go right. So what will you call it if you have tiny R waves in one in AVL and the axis goes right? You're going to call that posterior hemi block. If you got tiny Q waves and the thing goes left, you're going to call it anterior hemi block. Anybody doesn't get that? Yell at me now. Go ahead. If you don't get it, I know you'll forget it tomorrow. And then you'll have to read it again. I know that. But what I'm trying to do is make sure that the next time you see it, you say, oh, yeah, I remember this crap. There was some guy while I was falling asleep on a Thursday morning who was yelling at me about this. Oh, yeah, it'll come back faster next time. But you get this. Hemi blocks are not mysterious, are they? If you go left, cut this off. Cut the left anterior fascicle off, make the axis go here, and produce the Q waves because nothing goes down there. If you cut this off, make the axis go right, and produce the R waves because this is the only way it goes.
You cut that leg off, why does the axis deviate?
Okay, let's talk. And that's a confusing point, which I tried to present, but obviously not good enough. Let's take a Volkswagen and a Porsche. They're made by the same company, or used to be, made by the same company, and you start driving down the road. Which is going to go faster? The Porsche, probably. But just for argument. And so the Porsche will, and if there's a known destination, Bay City from Saginaw, who's going to get there first? Porsche is, isn't it? And then when it gets there, the person's going to turn off the motor and he's going to sit there and wait for the Volkswagen to arrive. So during the entire time the two cars drive down the road, there is a time when both of them are driving, and there's a time when one quits and the other's just driving. So there is a time in this process that this Volkswagen is the only thing that is having an impact on the road. Everybody else, there is nothing, the Porsche's gone. So in EKG, if you create a septum with bundled branches, you have two anatomic structures. Never think of bundled branches as being the same. They are anatomically distinct. They live on different sides of the continent. They don't know what the other guy is doing. The right bundle is not connected to the left bundle electrically. It doesn't know what it's doing. So like the Volkswagen and the Porsche, one bundle could transfer current quickly and the other could do it very slowly. Does that make sense? All right. Well, if that makes sense, then when the Porsche got there, the electrical current on one side went by, it has no more impact. To produce EKG deflection, you have to have voltage. There isn't any more once the engine is turned off. But the Volkswagen is still traveling. It's still producing voltage. So using this information, you started up the left anterior hemifascicle road with your Volkswagen. And the Porsche went down the right side and got rid of all the right side. And the voltage stopped. But the Volkswagen is still traveling. So all the voltage that is going to happen in this heart will happen because the Volkswagen has not got to the end of the left side, right? So everything that's going to happen in an EKG that has left anterior hemi block, everything that's going to happen towards the end is going to have to be left because the Volkswagen hasn't gotten here yet. So if we look at this, this is unfortunately bifascicular block. You can't use this because there are other factors that cause this. But essentially, the reason for the terminal vector forces in isolated blocks, and this is not isolated, but the reason for terminal vector forces in isolated blocks, if you have right bundle branch block, the entire bundle branch is gone, so the car driving to the road on the right side is going to take a long time to get there. So all the vectors will go right. So the terminal part of a QRS will look like it's going to the right. Remember, every EKG is a camera. Remember, when it goes towards you, it makes positive. When it goes away from you, it makes negative. Remember that? V5 and V6 sit here, right? On the chest. And if everything goes away from them, it's going to make a negative deflection if you have right bundle. See it? So that's why does that make sense to you? That it's a question of current transfer and speed and the difference between one side and the other. That's all. So you've just now begun, at least, hopefully, to get some concept of what hemi blocks are. All right, anybody beyond first year wants to take a crack at this EKG? Who wants to do it? If I don't hear a volunteer, I'm going to pick somebody. When I do that, that person doesn't get an easy ride. So volunteer, make it easy. Come on. Somebody say something. You got 5 seconds. What do you start out with? P-waves, good. So is this sinus rhythm? Yeah, you know, that one's sort of, I don't know. But you see everything else and you say, yeah, good enough for government work. Close enough. So sinus rhythm, is the PR interval normal? You can always read it. You know, this one doesn't have. Oh, yeah, it does. PR interval 152 milliseconds. That's normal. QR's duration 68 milliseconds. Is that normal? QT interval 404 milliseconds. Is that normal? That's normal. All right. What is the axis? Anybody in this room not know how to tell a QRS axis? Because I'll teach you that if you don't know. So everybody knows exactly how a QRS axis is determined? No problem? Yeah, see, he's drawing the pictures right to see. Watch him. He's got all that. Correct. Come on. Tell me what you just said. Don't be afraid of this. This is the only way you will solidify your knowledge. Remember, the human brain, when you guys sit down and you read a book, how do you know that you learned what you read? You have to regurgitate it. There's an input. There's a process. and there's an output. If you don't regurgitate what you read, you don't know that you know it. So when you cram, all right, here's a trick. When you cram, and you've got to know this much material for the exam tomorrow, here's a trick. Take a bunch of little pieces of paper, I don't care what they are, and keep them there, read a section, and regurgitate only the three or four things you need to remember. If you do that, if you output from your brain in the exam, you'll do it the same way. If you just read it and keep going, because you're in such a hurry to finish, you don't know what you know till you produce it. Trust me. School came really easy to me because my dad taught me this. And junior high, you know, school was a cakewalk because I figured out that the brain only knows what it knows when it's asked to produce it. And when I was 12, I looked like a star just because of that. So use this. It's a very, very solid point. Make just a few. I'm not telling you to write the whole thing down. And I'm not trying to tell you to memorize. This doesn't memorize something. What it does is it actually forces you to remember the same way when you're asked the question. So the axis, go ahead. How do you tell an axis? And? So lead one looks at the heart from zero. So everything is going to be on the left-hand side of my body if lead one is positive. Lead AVF looks at the heart from 90. And everything is going to be below or above if AVF is positive? All right, so let's make the quadrants. If lead one is positive, I'm on this side. If AVF is positive, I'm down here. So most of the time, I'm from 0 to 90, am I not? Everybody get this? It's that easy. And the problem is when you read it in the book, it is so damn confusing you want to throw the book away. And it's actually just that simple. So let me ask you a question. If AVF was positive and lead 1 was negative, where's the axis? It's here, isn't it? Becomes right axis. If both 1 and AVF are negative, where is it? Is that a possible axis to have? If you are between minus 270 and 0, is that an axis you can ever have? You have to have VTAC to have that. It isn't possible. It's a non-physiologic axis. Remember that. Any axis in which leads AVF and lead 1 are both negative, run for Con Edison. Battles. That's what you need. All right? Won't talk about T waves today. That's a long discussion. It's not a very good EKG. It doesn't project well. Nice. All right, let's look at this. What do you guys see here? Sinus rhythm or not? Anybody want to say sinus rhythm? Yeah. Okay, is it sinus tachycardia? You guys know that, right? If it's greater than 100, it's tachycardia. If it's less than 60, it's brittle. Let's forget that. So it's sinus rhythm. PR interval? It's good. PR in the machine says 72. QRS is 156. Is that normal? No. Greater than 120 becomes the beginnings of abnormal. Some books say 110. And that depends on, you'll read versions of incomplete block. Don't be confused by it. Someone's just trying to define the fact that something's tending to get bad. And that's what they're doing. All right, so we're going to say there's some sort of conduction delay here. We won't talk about what it is. Is the QRS, so the QRS width is quite large. The QT interval here, the corrected is 416. That's normal. What about the axis? Where's the axis? What do you guys think? Is that down or up? So let's draw the pictures, guys. Here's my line. That's down, so I'm over on this side. Everybody can see that? All right. Let's say, okay, so what about this one? AVF is up. So which quarter am I in? I'm down here. That's called right axis deviation. Anybody have a problem with that? So please, I'm asking you to do this for yourselves. When you go to work after today, every EKG you pick up, don't read the number in the top left-hand corner. Try and figure it out for yourself. It's the axis. Here's a little trick. Lead 2 is at 60 degrees, right? Lead 2 is at 60 degrees. And sometimes when you have to define left axis deviation, you have to define it as being less than minus 30 degrees. That's what the book says. Some books say minus 45, some say minus. So the only trick I want to leave behind in the world of axis for you is, if something is 60 degrees, and if it's completely equidistant, half up and half down, the vector has to be 90 degrees from a 60 degree lead to axis, which happens to be minus 30 degrees. So if you don't know whether something is or is not left axis, because what you saw is lead 1 is positive, lead AVF is negative, so you know it's in here. But you know that from 0 to minus 30, it's not left axis deviation, it's normal. And from minus 30 onwards, it's left axis deviation. Now, you've defined it in this quarter, but you can't define if it's called left axis deviation. Look at lead 2. It's at 60, and look at whether it's more positive, more negative, or equidistant. So if it was more positive, then it would be more towards this way. It would be not left axis deviation. But if it was more negative, then it's going to be more away from it. So if lead 2 is more negative than positive, it's left axis deviation. If it isn't, it's not. That's how you remember it. So you can get to the quarter with a simple trick we produced, but to go past that, to say whether or not it is or is not left axis deviation, just use lead 2. So here you have a right axis. Anybody say that QRS is normal or abnormal? Anybody want to try that? Is this QRS normal or abnormal? I don't want you to define it any more than that. Is it normal or abnormal? It's abnormal. And if you had to guess in your eyes when you look at this puppy, what about it is abnormal? Just vaguely, the attending is sitting there glowering at you while you're trying to fall all over yourself trying to define it. So if that was, what would you say? It looks wide, okay. Anything else? One of the things we have not talked about, this is a one-hour lecture on the genesis of the T-wave and how you use it, but is this ST segment T-wave normal? It's not really, is it? And I know I make a big deal out of nothing, I agree, but does this ST segment remind you of something? Does it look like something? If it is abnormal, does it look abnormal in a particular way? Is it abnormal because it's elevated or depressed or what? It looks like an elevated ST segment, and there are many bad things that cause ST elevation. The biggest one that you worry about is? Okay. Have you read in the book somewhere that says that if the QRS is abnormal, if the width of the QRS is abnormal, if it's a bundle branch block, have you read somewhere the fact that if you have that, you can't make the diagnosis of myocardial infarction? Anyone read this? You believe that, right? You read it in a book. Now, welcome to my world. This is where you live, all right? Here you have a guy with a right bundle, right axis deviation, but EKG things that bug you. So, ladies and gentlemen, yes, it's absolutely true that you can make a diagnosis of acute anterolateral myocardial infarction in the setting of right bundle branch block. That's what this is. Now, what happens is kind of fun. Because remember, you have RSR. That's what you have. But if you have an anterior infarct, what happens? You get QS complexes in V1, V2, V3. I hope I'm not going too fast here. Is that true? Does everybody know that? To make a diagnosis of remote anterior myocardial infarction, you got to get Q waves in the anterior leads. Is that okay to say? You guys know that? So if that's true, one of the things that happens is that the initial R begins to disappear and become an initial Q. Remember we said that if you have right bundle, you have a septum, right bundle's gone, you got to depolarize this way, V1 makes an R. But when you damage this by infarcting it, you lose that. So that's why the right bundle pattern begins to lose its initial positive deflection. So points of order. In the presence of right bundle branch block, do not be afraid to call myocardial infarction if the terminal ST segments have a typical appearance. If you think it's there, it very well might be. This is for your gold star people. In the presence of left bundle branch block, is there any myocardial infarction you're allowed to call? There is one, actually, and that in only some circumstances. If you see a classic ST segment of myocardial infarction in the inferior leads, you can call it. You won't be wrong. And from the purpose of ER, if the guy's got a new left bundle, he's dead anyway. He's got to be managed very aggressively. Left bundle is an independent predictor of mortality. It's an independent predictor of disaster. So if you see a new left bundle, from your perspective, you're going to have to manage them aggressively anyway. But to call it, there are many situations in real life. I don't know if I have one here. There are many situations in real life where the presence of ST segment, typical ST segment elevation with left bundle branch block in the inferior leads can be called as infarction. Sinus rhythm, yes or no? See, now it becomes easy, right? Drill, 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 P wave, sinus rhythm. Everybody knows that. PR interval 152, normal. QRS 96, normal. Anything wrong with this guy? What's the axis? AVF is up, lead one is up, axis is normal. No problem with that? So every time you pick up an EKG, guys, try it. I'm not telling you that I know anything. I'm telling you this is the stuff that's allowed me to survive through the years. That you, I always look, is it sinus rhythm? Is the PR good? Is the QRS good? What's the axis? Do this stuff in your head and do it as a matter of course. And I know it's boring and you'd rather be doing better things than looking at this stuff. But it does help sometimes to manage patients. So anybody want to make a diagnosis? Okay. What are these things? Reciprocal changes. Very good. Exactly. Just remember, and I just wanted to thank you for saying that, because everything is a camera, every event is singular, and every camera represents its version of that singular event. Reciprocal changes is like looking at the same thing from the other side. That's all. So very simple. A lot of the EKGs you get are that simple. You know, they look like this, and you don't have to kind of guess. These are all here. You don't have the reciprocal changes. You still have that. You see that? And I can get into the reciprocal changes of one in AVL and why one represents right coronary disease and one represents, there's all kinds of garbage out there. But from what you need to do with it, you don't really need to know that material, because it doesn't affect management. Sinus rhythm, yes or no? PR interval is 138, QRS is 82, QT is 438. Everybody's happy. Diagnosis? Hang on. Don't say anything. Anybody in this room who is a medical student is allowed to try this only. And if the medical students in this room do not get this, you do not get lunch. And you do not get to go to the bathroom. Dr. Satonic is buying lunch. Anyway, so anybody who's a medical student think that they see something wrong, please don't be afraid to make a mistake. That's when fun happens. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Say, I think that doesn't look right. What do you think? Anyone who's a medical student, does this look totally normal? What about it looks bad? Anything look bad to you? What leads look bad? Start there. What's bad about them? Right. And where's V1? V2, V3, V4, V5. And this is what? This is anterior. And V6, so V5 is here. That's more lateral. This is, what is this called? This is an anterolateral myocardial infarction. Not that hard to do, is it? Good. All right. You know, don't be afraid to commit yourself. You know, when I was a resident, I trained in a program in which we were told to do this, that when you were asked a question, you had a disclaimer on your answer that said you're here to learn. And if you committed yourself to an answer, you did so because you told your attending the limit of your knowledge. It was his responsibility to add to that. If you don't open your mouth, I don't know what you know, and I can't teach you what you should know. Remember this fact, that when you do rounds and you make the effort to discuss something, if you don't tell someone what you know, they cannot add to your knowledge because they don't know where you are. And I know we all go through life like, if I'm quiet and no one sees the fact that I have no freaking clue what this is, I'm at least going to look good because no one's going to know. And tonight, I promise I'll go home and I'll read this. And you don't. That's how it works. So after years, guys, I want you to understand the psychology of being a resident is not well taught to you. If I don't know what you don't know, I can't tell you, can I? Don't be afraid to explore the limit of your knowledge. By doing so, you will add to it. And you will find that as long as you know the fine line between asking questions and pestering the shit out of me, there's a line there, you're going to do fine. All right, enough. It's 8:30. Just a kind of potpourri of things. Thank you.